was looking at even people like Shibli Nu'mani, a very prominent Sunni alim of Indian subcontinent in this century. He says all the Sahaba were, you know, praying that, you know, may Rasul select me. Even those who sometimes used to say we are not into position, they said at least that night I had this desire that may I be selected. Next morning, all of them gathered outside the tent of Rasulullah. Rasulullah comes out. Nobody volunteered for that position. Why? It wasn't an occasion of volunteering your name. Because the first part you could say, يُحِبُّ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولُهُ, that you love Allah and Rasul. The second part, يُحِبُّهُ اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ, that Allah and the Rasul also loves him. So there was no matter of asking somebody to volunteer that position. Rasulullah looked around and everybody was thinking, maybe his eyes will fall on me or me or me. And then he didn't see the one whom he wanted to see. And he asked them, Aina Ali? Where is Ali? Quickly they said, oh, Ali is not feeling well. His eyes are hurting. Rasulullah didn't stop there. You know, Rasulullah said, doesn't matter, call him. He comes. And Rasulullah called him close, took the saliva from his tongue, put it in his eyes. This is even in Sunni historians and Shia narrations also. Right away, Amir al-Mu'mineen was cured of the pain and the ailment that he had in his eyes. And Rasulullah gave him the alam and the command. And he goes, and you know the rest of the story, how he was able to conquer the fortress of Khaybar under the command of Marhab.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad. Please stay tuned.
غفلت بیماری مهلک بشر است.
Negligence is a deadly disease for humans. In today's world, the means for being negligent are more than before. Imam As-Sajjad alayhi salam in a beautiful hadith states, Allah the Almighty asks me to do some obligatory deeds, and thus He is my creditor. Therefore, we are always indebted to Allah in our lives.
بعضی‌ها که خودشون از خدا طلبکار می‌دونن متأسفانه.
Unfortunately, some people think that Allah owes them something. They complain about their life and they tell Allah that if their problems are not solved, they will not worship Him anymore. Somehow, they threaten Allah. These people are negligent about the blessings of Allah and His mercy upon themselves. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
violence is back again in Sudan as the army and a paramilitary group calling itself the Rapid Support Forces or RSF are fighting fierce battles in several cities, including the capital Khartoum. The fighting erupted Saturday after weeks of power struggles between Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and his deputy, Mohamed Hamdan Daglo, known as Hemeti or Little Mohammed, who leads the heavily armed RSF. Witnesses said huge blasts and intense gunfire rattled buildings in the suburbs of the capital Khartoum as tanks rumbled on the streets and fighter jets roared overhead.
Now a lot of people are just kind of like hiding in their homes. It's been going on since yesterday morning. It kind of like there was a lull at night, and then it started back up again like early morning, and like 1 or 2, like super loud.
According to Central Committee of Sudan Doctors, scores of people, including civilians, have so far been killed and many others injured. The battles also left several members of the United Nations World Food Program dead, prompting the agency to suspend operation in the impoverished nation. Even a 3-hour pause to open safe passage for humanitarian cases proposed by the United Nations failed to stop the fighting. Heavy gunfire could still be heard in central Khartoum near the airport and dense black smoke billowed from the surrounding area. The RSF said it was in control of several places, including the airport, the presidential palace, and other strategic locations. The army, however, insisted that they are the ones who are still in control of all those areas. The fighting was soon extended to other regions, cities, and towns, including the western Darfur region and the city of Omdurman. The violence drew international outcry. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for justice without delay. He had earlier warned that an escalation in the fighting would further aggravate the already precarious humanitarian situation. The Arab League and the African Union separately condemned the violence and called for an immediate ceasefire. Russia, China, and the European Union also came out vocal against the intense fighting in Sudan, urging restraint. The fighting in Sudan comes as many around the globe have warned that the conflict could plunge the country into a deeper chaos. After all, if the Northeast African nation is not a country which has seen the most number of coups, but it has been the scene of numerous such moves in its history. It was in April 2019 when former President Omar al-Bashir, who had ruled Sudan since the 1989 coup, was brought down from power by the country's military. That after weeks of mass protests over the cost of basic goods, austerity measures, high inflation, and an end to wheat and fuel subsidies. The Transitional Military Council then took power and agreed to a power-sharing deal with protesters. The outcome? A sovereign council tasked with leading the transition process. The council was set to be ruled by a military figure for 21 months, followed by a civilian rule for 18 months. But a handover of power never happened. Things went ahead the same way until October 2021, when the military ruled by Burhan took control of the government in yet another military coup. The move triggered international aid cuts and sparked near-weekly protests met by a deadly crackdown. That was exactly the time when differences arose between Burhan and his deputy Daglo. Burhan believed that the coup was necessary to include more factions in politics. Daglo, however, called the coup a mistake that failed to bring about change. Now, given the recent developments in Sudan, both Burhan and Daglo have calculated that the leadership contest is now a zero-sum game and therefore have moved on each other. What seems to be clear is the fact that the Sudanese people, who have already paid a high price for installing a civilian government, are the ones who must stand on the sidelines as both military leaders fight it out till the bitter end. What seems to be of high urgency for Sudan is that power has to be given back to its real owners, the people. However, the fighting and yet another brutal civil war in the Northeast African nation are dashing long-held hopes for a transition to civilian-led democracy. As the Saudi war on Yemen enters its ninth year, authorities from both sides have begun releasing hundreds of prisoners captured during the deadly conflict. The forces in Aden, who were backed by Saudi Arabia during the war, agreed to release 250 Ansarullah fighters and send them back to Sana'a. In return, the Ansarullah movement said it released a total of more than 180 detainees, including Saudis and Sudanese soldiers. The prisoners also include forces loyal to former Saudi-backed Yemeni President Abdel Rabbouh Mansour Hadi and send them back to Aden. Among them were high-profile figures, including brother of former President Nasser Mansour Hadi and former Yemeni Defense Minister Mahmoud al-Sobeihi. The prisoners talked about their feelings as they were set to join their families.
It's the most beautiful day of our lives because we got out of captivity and we're now safely heading to our country and under the protection of the Red Cross.
I now feel proud and honored as I'm returning to the Yemeni land. I will kiss its soil because it's like my tender mother. Greeting to all the Yemeni people.
Those, along with other prisoners, made up of some 900 captives who are released under an agreement reached in Switzerland in March. The agreement was the largest prisoner swap since October 2020. The International Committee of the Red Cross, which managed and facilitated the prisoner swap, said with this act of goodwill, hundreds of families torn apart by conflict are being reunited. Our deep desire is that these releases provide momentum for a broader political solution. Some within the Yemeni government in Sana'a said they expected a flurry of prisoner exchanges during the coming months. They said other such agreements are likely to be struck after the holy month of Ramadan to release all prisoners that can make up around 15,000. The prisoner swap deals, including the one which took place during a three-day period as of Friday, and the possible upcoming agreements, are seen by many around the world as a confidence-building measures aimed at creating trust between the warring sides in Yemen and preparing the grounds for upcoming peace talks. The prisoner swap agreement between Riyadh and Ansarullah movement in Yemen comes as the movement's chief negotiator, Mohammed Abdel Salam, has hailed the negotiations as serious and positive. Abdel Salam says more talks have been planned to discuss outstanding issues, which include a permanent truce, full reopening of the southern ports and Sana'a airport, payment of public sector wages, and the withdrawal of foreign forces from Yemen. Sources say Saudi Arabia is planning to announce the end of the devastating war on Yemen. After all, the kingdom was leading a coalition that has been attacking the impoverished nation since March 2015. To reinstate Hadi, Riyadh launched a brutal war in collaboration with a number of its allies and with arms and logistical support from the United States and several other Western countries. The objective was to crush the Ansarullah movement, which has been ruling the country since Hadi fled to Saudi Arabia in 2015. To achieve its goals, Riyadh used the most sophisticated weapons it purchased from its Western allies against the Yemeni people. Not to mention that the Arab Kingdom imposed an all-out blockade on the country to bring the impoverished nation to its knees. According to UN figures, hundreds of thousands of people have so far been killed and millions of others displaced. The war also destroyed Yemen's vital infrastructure, leaving millions of people across the country in desperate need of vital necessities. UN estimates show some 4.5 million people have been internally displaced and more than two-thirds of the population living below the poverty line. Now, with the recent prisoner swap deal, it seems that Saudi Arabia is seeking to pull out itself from a quagmire that has been very costly on all levels. The princesses in Riyadh seem to have come to the understanding that billions of Saudi petrodollars have gone into waste and are seeking to make a U-turn in their political approach toward regional and international developments.
International Quds Day Rallies 2023. Massive crowds filled the streets of all major cities in the Islamic Republic. The show of support for Palestinians was astounding. But these rallies were not limited to just Iran. This year, more people came out in support of Al-Quds Day an occasion designated by the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, over 40 years ago. One day prior to the event, Iran and several Arab countries like Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Iraq held naval parades, something not done in the past. Then came the show of support by resistance groups and religious leaders.
It is enough for the Arabs and the Muslims in the world and all the peoples of the world. And also, Al-Quds has its significance for Palestine, and this is part and parcel of the religious duties. In this state, we need to shoulder the efforts to support the West Bank and Al-Quds.
But why was this but stay different? For starters, the Al-Aqsa Mosque was a scene of multiple violations and desecrations by Israeli forces and settlers. The beating of Palestinian worshippers brought world condemnation against Israel and its officials. In the spotlight, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and extreme far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. When it came to the issue of Al-Quds, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was forced to announce that the Al-Aqsa Mosque would be limited only to Palestinian worshippers until the end of the holy month of Ramadan. His minister Itamar Ben-Gvir slammed the move. Many saw that as a sign of a further rift with Netanyahu. Never before, Israel is finding itself to be isolated and weak. On the one hand, Israel is unraveling from within. Strikes and protests against the so-called judicial reforms to have extended to over 3 months now. Meanwhile, Israelis are leaving Israel en masse. On the other hand, the economy is being battered. Massive capital flights. Investor confidence at an all-time low. After all, who wants to invest in an economy where there are massive protests in which the fate of the ruling coalition is not known? His partnership with what some have called fascists and extremists has deteriorated Israel's standing, even with its staunchest allies, especially the U.S. A group of U.S. senators have urged the U.S. president not to use taxpayers' money in Israeli settlements and to stop violating Palestinian rights. According to a recent poll by Gallup, for the first time, more Democrats sympathize with Palestinians than they do with Israelis. 49% of Democrats answered that they sympathize more with Palestinians, an 11-point increase over the past year. Meanwhile, Israel is facing an unprecedented national security threat from resistance groups. Recently, a barrage of rockets from resistance groups from southern Lebanon was met with a counterfire from Israel, which only targeted open areas, in fear of not getting involved in a war, especially with Hezbollah. And a further threat to Israel, the geopolitical shift in West Asia from Iran's reconciliation with Saudi Arabia has thrown Israel's security to a state of red alert. Israeli hopes of normalization with Saudi Arabia appear to be dashed, at least for now. Counting on Arab-Israeli alliance in the face of Iran and the axis of resistance is over, said the Hezbollah chief, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. As a result of Iran-Saudi normalization, the axis of resistance has been recalibrated, especially with Syria coming back into the fold. 21 years ago, George Bush uttered these words in his State of the Union address.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world.
Ironic that now those words hold true for the U.S. and Israel, especially when it comes to their presence in the West Asia region.
On April the 5th, French President Emmanuel Macron made a three-day visit to China. It was Macron's first presidential visit to China since the COVID pandemic. The French president called on European countries to lower their dependence on the U.S. dollar and resist pressure to become vassal states of Washington or get dragged into the China-U.S. conflict over Taiwan. If the tensions between the two superpowers heat up, we won't have the time nor the resources to finance our strategic autonomy and we will become vassals. He further noted that the great risk for Europe is to get involved in a crisis that does not belong to it. The worst thing would be to think that we Europeans must be followers and adapt ourselves to the American rhythm and a Chinese overreaction.
La France est pour le quo à Taiwan.
France is for the status quo in Taiwan. France supports the one-China policy and the search for a peaceful settlement of the situation. This is moreover the position of the Europeans and is a position which has always been compatible with the role of ally. But it is precisely here that I insist on the importance of strategic autonomy. Being allies does not mean being a vassal.
The comments come amid heightened tensions between the US and China over Taiwan. China staged a large-scale military drill after Taiwan's leader met with the US House Speaker in California.
China and France have further expanded their economic and trade cooperation through the visit, which in fact has once again confirmed that the economic and trade cooperation acts as the ballast and stabilizer of the bilateral relations. As it is known to all, the visit took place against the backdrop that the United States is clamoring about decoupling or disruption of industrial chains of China. And the Biden administration has also been suppressing his European allies in the aspect. Therefore, the consensus and the fact that both sides continue to advance economic and trade cooperation by consolidating traditional domains and exploring new fields during the visit of President Macron to China are a powerful response to the so-called decoupling and disruption policies of the US.
Macron highlighted the point that Europe should be a third power in the world order along with the US and China. He also emphasized the risks to Europe of the US Inflation Reduction Act, a $369 billion green subsidy plan. Macron also said Europe should reduce its dependence on the extraterritoriality of the US dollar, a stance that is likely to raise eyebrows in Washington. Macron's comments about Europe's independence from the United States and its devastating reliance on the US dollar has sparked anger and concern in Washington. The White House reapparently affirmed ties with Paris.
Again, I'll let President Macron speak to his comments. We're very comfortable and confident in the strong alliance and the strong friendship that exists between our two countries and the fact that we have been working together on the continent. And elsewhere around the world with France, whether it's, I mentioned the Indo-Pacific, certainly on Ukraine, in Africa, in the Sahel, going after terrorist threats there. I mean, there's a lot of terrific bilateral cooperation just alone between the United States and France. We're focused on that. We're focused on making sure that together we're meeting the national security requirements of both our peoples.
Earlier, Republican Senator Marco Rubio urged European countries to clarify pretty quickly if Macron spoke for Europe or France alone.
And so I think this is a good moment for us to ask Europe, does Macron speak for all of Europe? Is Macron now the head of Europe? Is he now the most powerful leader in Europe? Because if he is, then there's some things we're going to need to change. Number one, you know, Europe, including France specifically, has depended heavily on the United States for 70 years for their own defense. As far as not getting involved in other conflicts that are not ours, we need to ask Europe, does he speak for them? Because we're pretty heavily involved in Ukraine right now. We're spending a lot of our taxpayer money on a European war.
Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, it's been Europe which has paid the high price for the conflict. The war has mostly benefited the United States and its huge military-industrial complex. That's one of the reasons why the Washington regime is pumping more weapons to Ukraine to keep the war going. Furthermore, France is seeking economic independence from the United States. Just recently, France conducted its first LNG purchase in the Chinese yuan. The roots of France's diplomacy of balance date back to General Charles de Gaulle's attempts to counterweight US dominance. Under de Gaulle, France became the first Western nation to recognize the People's Republic of China back in 1964.
But I think fundamentally what Macron is aiming at is strengthened Europe with regards to Russia, with regards to China, and also with regards to the US, I think is something that is largely shared within Europe. The problem being that his style of communication, his vocabulary, strategic autonomy, European sovereignty, is at times misunderstood, misinterpreted.
Macron may not be able to persuade the whole European bloc to reduce its dependence on the United States.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of barakah, and in the month of Ramadan. So we're going to deal with this, in fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. I'm Sheikh Chavid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the rules and laws of jurisprudence related to fasting and Ramadan with Sheikh Chavid. Sheikh Chavid, as you know, one of the following three things occur at the beginning or end of each month. We are talking about the moon crescent.
Sure.
And sometimes the crescent sets before the sunset. Sometimes it is along with the sunset, right? And sometimes the moon crescent, in fact, sets after the sunset. So would you please, shed some light on all of these conditions and the rule about the new month? And when is the start of the new month, for example?
Well, according to His Eminence, it makes no difference whether the crescent sets before or after or along with the sunset.
Mm-hmm.
What is important is the fact that sighting the crescent after noon is enough. Afternoon is enough. If you sight the crescent at any time after noon, it's enough to consider the night after the sighting to be the first night of the lunar month.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, for example, let's say see it on the night, let's assume that tomorrow is the first day of Shawwal, okay? And if you see it today afternoon or any time afternoon, so tomorrow it's going to be the first day of Shawwal and the Eid day, of course. So it doesn't make any difference whether the crescent is sighted before or after or along with the sunset.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, and another question that should the sighting happen or take place with the naked eyes, or if we use some of the technological tools such as a binocular, telescope, and the like, are they also part of the sighting and it completes the sighting?
Well, this is a matter of contention and debate among the scholars. The scholars, the religious authorities are polarized on this matter.
Mm-hmm.
Some prominent scholars believe that telescopes, devices, and instruments such as these should not be used to sight the moon. But there are some other scholars, including Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, who believe that the sighting of the new crescent with these instruments is also reliable. And its ruling does not differ from that of naked eye. Okay, if one sees or sights the crescent with the naked eye, that is okay. But if he does not, and he uses some like telescopes or something, or he, for example, uses a helicopter to go above the cloud and to try to locate the moon somewhere in the sky, there's no objection to him. And of course, the beginning of the month of Shawwal, the beginning of the month of lunar month is established.
Mm-hmm. I see. And another question, Sheikh Chawid, quite related to this, if, the crescent marking of the beginning of the Shawwal is not seen or observed in a city by the local people, but yet you see the radio, for example, announces this is the beginning of Shawwal, for example, okay?
Yes.
What happens to the local people? Should they act on the radio announcement or should they ascertain by investigating whether Shawwal has started or commenced?
Well, there is something we need to pay attention. In some predominantly Sunni populated countries, we see that they don't care about sighting the moon, and they simply announce the Eid day when, and they fast, let's say, sometimes for 29 days, sometimes for 30 days. So we sometimes do see that they announce the Eid one day or before the moon is actually sighted.
Mm-hmm.
So Shia Muslims living in those countries should check, and you know, the fatwa of their religious authorities. They should not break their fast on the announcement made by official announcements made by those countries, respective countries. Every individual has to act according to the fatwa of his own mujtahid. Now, if he is, for example, his mujtahid announces or in a statement that the moon has been ascertained, it has been sighted somewhere, and then he announces that the next day is going to be the Eid day, so he should act according to it. He should break his fast, and of course, but if he says that it has not yet been established, it has not been ascertained yet, then he should be careful not to break his fast on the following day. Even though the vast majority of people who are Sunnis, they are celebrating the Eid, but he should not, do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much, Javid. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back with more questions related to fasting and Ramadan, and also the beginning of the month of Shawwal. Thank you. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, the host of this program, and Shahrat with our guest speaker. We are still talking about the questions of jurisprudence, or the answers to them, based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini and related to the month of Ramadan and the beginning of the month of Shawwal. And Sheikh Chabit, sometimes it happens that the crescent marking becomes very much difficult,
yes,
right? Due to many reasons, right? It's not only, related to, for example, the beginning of the month of Shawwal. Sometimes it happens to the beginning of the month of Ramadan, right?
Yes.
So the beginning of any month, basically. So if it happens that even they couldn't count the correct days, or the beginning of, for example, the previous month, like Sha'ban,
yes,
right? And so they enter Ramadan without knowing it. So the number of days of the month of Ramadan couldn't add up.
Yes.
Like, to, for example, 29 days. It might, turn out to be 28 days, because they couldn't recognize that it was like the previous month or the beginning of the new month, which is Ramadan. So they caught up with it. All right. Could people like Muslims in all of the world, like, for example, in Japan,
yes,
go by the horizon of some of the other Islamic countries like Iran? All right.
Yes.
Could they go by their own hometown's horizon and rely on their regular calendar? So what's the rule?
Yeah, if the first of Ramadan is not evidenced,
you know, there's no indication that it is the first of Ramadan, then, of course, fasting is not obligatory because there are reasons in demonstrative arguments in which are, you know, which we do not want to touch on. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, for such people, fasting is not obligatory as long as there is no evidence that it is the beginning of the month of Ramadan. However, if it is evidenced later that this day was actually the first of Ramadan, he should make up for that day, and there, that day he should observe the qada, and there's no penalty for him. And while if the new crescent of Shawwal has not been ascertained, even by being sighted in an adjacent city, which is united in horizon with one's city, on the evidence of two just witnesses, or on the basis of a decree by a hakim ishara or a religious authorities, then it is obligatory to fast on that day. Okay. Mm. So when the sighting, the moon has not been sighted, because there, if two just person people bear witness, testify to the fact that they have sighted the moon, okay, so it's enough. If there are not two just people to witness or to testify, then it's not established. And also, if a hakim ishar, who is reliable, of course, and who is the ruling authority, the religious authority, does not make an announcement, of course, then it is obligatory to fast because the crescent of the month has not been established.
Mm, I see. Thank you very much, Javid.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope that these captured some of the questions you had in mind related to the month of Ramadan and fasting. So please keep us in your du'as, especially in these blessed days. And thank you very much for listening to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies. This is your program, A Muslim Lady. I am Asma. I have the pleasure to be your host. And in here we have Sister Zainab with us. Welcome, sister.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much for having me.
Wa alaikum assalam. It's always a pleasure to have you here. And I'm sure we're going to have so much of interesting stuff to talk about. In the previous session, we were talking about being fair and how is it to make a balance between our emotional part and the part that we have to use as to bring about fairness.
Yeah.
And being impartial and making just decisions. There comes a question that says, if I am going to be fair with others and I am being unfair with myself, is it still being fair?
No, it's not being fair.
Uh-huh.
Because you are fair in the unfair world.
Mm-hmm.
You're unfair with the same person who is being fair with everyone else, that is yourself. So being fair with self is very, very important. And what does that mean? How could we know, first of all,
yeah.
that are we fair with ourselves
uh-huh.
or not? We cook, we clean.
We do too much of chores.
Yeah.
And we go for a job outside the home.
Inside home, outside home.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a woman is all the engine, the basic engine that runs the house, if not financially, but although whatever she does, she could be said the main engine. And whatever the man is gaining, it could be said that he's putting fuel into
exactly.
that engine. Yeah.
So, fair enough.
Yeah. So when she does not have leisure time for herself,
mm-hmm.
she's actually being very unfair to herself.
Yes. Now, I guess the Muslim ladies who are listening to us, they can ask themselves this question, how fair I am to myself?
Yeah. How much time do you go for exercises? How much time do you go for swimming? How
yeah.
much time do you give your body? You know, it's not, unfortunately, what the world today has taught us to give time to yourself or to be fair enough with yourself is to go for the body image.
Yeah, exactly. To be perfect in all details.
Yeah, to go and, I don't know, put on those inductions, be that whitening, be that making you thinner and
yeah.
other kind of beauty things. That's not, again, being fair with yourself.
Because still you may devote too much of time for your beauty, but you do not enjoy yourself.
I won't call putting on inductions on your body to be devoting time for beauty.
Yeah, exactly.
You're actually injecting something. You're taking in pain
mm-hmm.
just to look what?
Just to look perfect in the eyes of society.
Yeah. And for what? For whom?
Yeah.
And for how long?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because
yeah.
it's all time's fool. So pampering yourself is actually how much time you go for your, you know, how
yeah.
much leisure time you have, basically, how much refreshment time you have. Even in our religious teachings, we have been told that divide your time into three parts. One part for your work, another part for your
sleep,
for your worship and leisure time as well.
Yeah.
We have this division of time in our religion, a timetable has been given how you could actually manage your time, manage your 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So
giving yourself time, I guess it means to devote a special time, you with your own self.
Yeah.
And do whatever that makes you happy as a woman, as this person who's doing too much of things and who's taking too much of burdens on her shoulder.
This engine needs to check how many times I got to wash myself, you know,
mm-hmm.
I don't know how many times I got to change the
oil.
Take
care of myself.
Exactly. To take care, not just physically,
yeah.
but also spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going spiritually low, then things would again change.
Yeah, because
as we read in Du'a Kumail, Zalamtu Nafsi, that
yeah.
I have done zulm, I have done unfairness to my nafs, to myself, that we are talking in spiritual aspect. So if
mm-hmm.
as a woman, I again come and do this unfairness to myself, like, you know, I get indulged into something that's unusual for me as per Islamic guidelines, then I won't be able to maintain that balance again.
Exactly.
In my home, outside my home. And that balance will be lost.
Yeah,
so I've got to be fair enough.
In the hustles and bustles of the life, in all these ups and downs, sometimes all a woman needs is to lie down, to close her eyes, and think about nothing except herself. Or just what is going on in her life. So sometimes these very little tiny things we can do to ourselves can do too much to heal our problems or wounds or whatever that might happen to this emotional creature who tries to be fair with everyone, and still she doesn't care about herself.
That's again unfairness. So
yeah.
That's why she should be fair enough,
yeah.
even with her body and mm-hmm. even when it comes to a spiritual aspect.
Exactly. Right now, let's be fair with this episode and go for a short break. is Muslim Lady, and we're talking about you, the ladies out there, and I hope you're enjoying it up until now. So we talked about being fair. Right now, I have another question for you.
Yes.
As you see in this modern world, women are working side by side with men. And then they study, they go too high in their education, they become independent and whatever. And the moment she's going to marry, everybody thinks, okay, this is death to her social life, to her career. Things get difficult for her, and maybe she thinks marriage gets to be an obstacle into her improvement. So what are your explanations for that?
I coincidentally have the same experiences. Like when I got married, all my friends gave me just one message. Your career is over.
You killed yourself.
Somebody was telling me, you were a flying bird and now your wings are cut down. Somebody would tell me, like, you're gone, you're dead. It's over. Somebody would tell me, you got married, it was better for you to go and die with stoning.
Yes.
Somebody would have.
They were so cruel to you.
Yeah, like, you know, this is what it is thought when it comes to marriage. But does marriage mean that it's a full stop in your life?
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to educational aspect. Mm-hmm. Because everyone who was talking to me was talking to me in terms of career, education, and different things.
Yeah.
But now when they see today we are doing Muslim Lady together, the same people are amazed, they are surprised, and much more. Mm-hmm. So
inspire them.
Yeah. So I was saying that marriage is definitely not a full stop in a woman's life. Mm-hmm.
Now, let's be honest. Marriage is going to make her situation maybe a bit difficult because she has to make more of plans, because she has to make more of priorities. You know what I mean? I mean, we can say that, okay, by marriage, nothing is going to change in your life, in your career, in your education. Yes, it's going to change, and the change that's going to happen is that you're going to have much more of things to plan for. You know what I mean?
It all depends on what kind of person you choose, basically, to live with.
Yeah.
We have a choice. Like, for example, if I say to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, hey God, you gave me an unfair brother. You gave me unfair sister. You gave me unfair father. Here am I, you know, asking this kind of thing to Allah. Maybe it may have some, I won't say definitely, maybe it may have some value. I can ask because I did not choose my brother or sister or father to be my sister among the world. But when it comes to marrying, I can't tell this to God that I got married to the wrong person. It's all your fault.
Yeah.
Choice was all mine, okay? Mm-hmm. So it depends.
On the person you choose.
Person you choose and how he goes on with you in your life. Like we see very beautiful examples from Lady Zahra and Imam Ali alayhi salam's life. When it comes to educational aspect, she had reached a highest level of education because she was directly learning things from Prophet, peace be upon him.
Yeah.
And when she was learning from him, she would teach all that to Imam Ali alayhi salam, and she once says to Imam Ali alayhi salam, come, let me tell you something, what was in the past, what's going on right now, and what would be happening in the future.
In the future.
So that was her level of, that ilm, that education, mm-hmm. the knowledge that she had perceived from Prophet, peace be upon him. And when Imam Ali alayhi salam listens to her, he gets so super excited. He goes to Prophet, peace be upon him, and he tells him about things, what Fatima salam alayha had told him. And Prophet, peace be upon him, tells him, like, oh Ali, don't you know that Fatima, the Noor of Fatima, her light is from our light.
Yeah.
She's a part of us. And then he gets again super excited. And what does he do? This is important.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to sujood, prostration, you know. So what I mean is, which man do you see today who sees that his wife has reached a highest level of education or mm-hmm. highest form of knowledge she has right now and goes and performs sujood?
Okay.